Good morning, this is Brian Trumbore with your Week in Review for Saturday, March 26th. Let me just say, first off, there's obviously a ton going on, particularly this weekend in the Middle East, and I'm only going to touch on Libya for the purpose of this podcast, but of course you can get all the details on the goings-on in places like Syria and Bahrain in my Week in Review column at stocksnews.com. But first off, can you figure out what is going on in Libya? Anders Fogh Rasmussen, a good man who is NATO's Secretary General, said it's a coalition operation and a NATO operation. But as I went to post Saturday morning, even as I see just a few hours ago, NATO has agreed to enforce the no-fly zone as well as command all military operations. The questions are still many. In two polls, Reuters and CNN, though, 79% and 77% of Americans, respectively, believe the U.S. and our allies should remove Gaddafi. But our own president, who once called for Gaddafi's ouster, now doesn't specify if this is part of the mission. As for the coalition itself, the U.S., France, the U.K., Denmark, Canada, Spain, Italy, Belgium, Qatar, and the UAE, as best I can figure. It's the first three really leading the charge, and nothing would have happened had France's Nicolas Sarkozy and Britain's David Cameron not dragged Obama kicking and screaming into the fray like a child who had just been told the high school kids were taking over the basketball court. There was a time that Sarkozy wanted to do the entire operation himself because he can argue he has the most to lose with four French-speaking countries strategic to France in the region. Tunisia, Algeria, Chad, and Niger, let alone that it imports oil from Libya, with French oil giant Total controlling an important Libyan oil field. Both France and Italy, though, understand what the real issue is with turmoil in Libya, immigration. Italy's already seen 15,000 from Tunisia cross the sea to land on the Italian island of Lampedusa, and Italy's foreign minister has projected that unless the region cools down, up to 350,000 will eventually flood Italy, France, and all points north and east. That's why I keep talking about the rise of the far right, anti-immigrant parties in Europe, and unrest in Tunisia, Libya, and Egypt, for starters, is fueling this rise as the immigrants stress social services already under the gun through austerity budgets, let alone the rise in crime that follows such waves. But back to the coalition, there is also stern opposition. China expressed deep concern and warned of a humanitarian disaster if calls for ceasefire and Libya aren't met. China and Russia were among the five Security Council members abstaining in the UN vote that authorized the creation of a new no-fly zone. And speaking of Russia, Prime Minister Vladimir Putin said, quote, the resolution is defective and flawed. It allows everything. It resembles medieval calls for crusades. At least President Medvedev fired back that in no way is it acceptable to use expressions that in essence lead to a clash of civilizations. Otherwise, everything may end up far worse. Turkey's Prime Minister Erdogan vented his anger at French President Sarkozy. Quote, I wish that those who only see oil, gold mines, and underground treasures when they look into that direction would see the region through a prism of conscience from now on. Erdogan went on to say that the same people who were reluctant to let Turkey into the EU, read France, now spoke in terms of crusades in Libya, echoing Putin's criticism. Republican Senator Richard Lugar of Indiana, as respected a foreign policy voice as there is in Congress, summed it up. There needs to be a plan about what happens after Gaddafi. Who will be in charge then and who pays for this all? President Obama so far has only expressed vague hopes. Again, on the Middle East, I have further details. I apologize for jumping around here. Turning to Wall Street, there is zero reason for the equity markets to be rallying as they have the past 6-7 days, period. It doesn't mean they should have been tanking, but the biggest rally since last July, come on. I was watching Bob Pisani, CNBC's floor reporter on the New York Stock Exchange. And on Thursday, he was speaking about the low volatility and light volume on the street despite the sudden rally in the face of some awful news, and he inadvertently issued a loaded statement. The low volume, low volatility days are because, quote, you don't have the high frequency trading, which only enters the picture on the high volatility days. Of course, high frequency trading takes Wall Street's casino to the 100th degree. In other words, sports fans, yeah, we rallied back after our little hiccup of the past few weeks as oil soared amid Middle East strife, and then Japan hit the front page in horrifying fashion. And it was an orderly rally, powering ever higher. But when the volatility picks up again, we'll see the reemergence of the computers making thousands of trades in milliseconds, and then we'll have a real market again. It's enough to make you sick, as if the hard news headlines of the day don't have you reaching for the trash can already. Oh, there is semi-rational trading going on if, say, a Research in Motion misses estimates or gives poor guidance, or Caterpillar is an obvious beneficiary of increased mining or construction projects in the Far East. But otherwise, more often than not, the day-to-day action is a joke. What isn't a joke these days, however, is Japan. It remains an unmitigated disaster. There isn't one person on the planet who can tell you definitively what is going to happen with the nuclear plant at Fukushima, for example. I mean, think about some of the things we've been told just the past week. At first, with the power out at the facility, there was the rush to dump seawater on the reactors and to replenish the cooling pools that were drying up. But it took a week before anyone started saying the seawater could corrode the pipes. Let's see, we have 99,000 gallons of salt water over here, and these pipes weren't designed for 99,000 gallons of salty water, and oh my god, these pipes could corrode and release more radiation. And away from the plant, but dealing with Japan's power issue and production disruptions of all kinds, including shipping lines restricting or barring their ships from calling on ports in Tokyo Bay over radiation concerns, as reported by the New York Times Saturday, as I went to post, consider this. Japan's power grid is essentially in four parts. Think of it like America's east and west coast, and then divide the rest of the country into north and south. It's my understanding that in Japan, none of the four regions can help each other out. A shortage on the east coast of the country can't be picked up by transferring power from the southwest, let's say. Now, as bad as America's grid is, and it's truly pathetic, we at least have the capability to borrow from other regions if one goes down, or borrow from Canada, which supplies much of Northeast America with either direct power or backup. Yet another reason to support our great friends by drinking Canadian beer. You see, those talking about Japan's resilience are missing some essential points. They might be able to rebuild a road quickly, but they have a power grid that wasn't designed for disasters, even though the entire country is basically living on a fault line. The initial cost for Japan to rebuild is $310 billion, and the World Bank says it will take 5 years. I obviously have no idea how close either figure will prove to be, or what the radiation impact on food and water will eventually end up being either. What I do know is, as much as we want the Japanese people to succeed, they have some mammoth issues that can't be papered over by some news analyst saying, boy, you just don't know the spirit of the Japanese. As I told you last week, I do know it's a country that has a hopelessly corrupt political system, and while it's still king in some high-tech areas, the economy hasn't done squat in two decades. This week, Morgan Stanley said Japan would go through a short and deep recession. A GDP shortfall of -3% when Morgan Stanley had forecast growth of 2% this year. I'll say it's long and deep. Of all the people whose analysis I read, if I had to pick just one for clear-headed thinking, it would be former Morgan Stanley Asia chairman Stephen Roach. So I present his opinion in depth, which was a syndicated column, but I saw it in the Daily Star. Stephen Roach, the devastation, both human and physical, from the earthquake and tsunami in Japan is unfathomable. It is impossible at this point to gauge the full extent of the damage with any degree of precision. But we can nonetheless begin to assess its potential spillover effects on the rest of Asia and other major economies around the world. On the surface, the world's two largest economies have little to fear. Japan accounts for only 5% of America's exports and 8% of China's. under the worst-case outcome of a complete disruption to the Japanese economy, the direct repercussions on the United States and Chinese economies would be small, shaving no more than a few tenths of a percentage point off their annual growth rates. Within the so-called G10 developed economies, Australia has the largest direct exposure to Japan, which absorbs about 16% of their total exports. South Korea, the third largest economy in East Asia, is at the other end of the scale, relying on Japanese demand for only about 6% of its exports. But the narrow view misses the most critical consideration. This Japan shock has not occurred at a time of great economic strength. That is true not only of Japan itself, where two lost decades have left a once vigorous economy on a less than 1% growth trajectory since the early 1990s, but is also true of the broader global economy, which was only just beginning to recover from the worst financial crisis and recession since the 1930s. Stephen Roach continues, "Context is vital. Notwithstanding the euphoric resurgence of global equity markets over the past 2 years, the world economy remains fragile. What markets seem to have forgotten is that post-bubble, post-financial crisis recoveries tend to be anemic. Economies grow at something much closer to their stall speeds, thus lacking the cyclical escape velocity required for a self-sustaining recovery. As a result, post-crisis economies are far more vulnerable to shocks and prone to relapses than might otherwise be the case. Alas, there is an added complication that makes today's shocks all the more vexing. Governments and central banks have exhausted the traditional ammunition upon which they have long relied during terms of economic duress. That is true of both monetary and fiscal policy, the two mainstays of modern counter-cyclical stabilization. Policy interest rates are close to zero in the major economies in the developed world, and outsized budget deficits are the norm. As a result, unconventional and untested policies such as so-called quantitative easing have become the rage among central bankers. All along, such unconventional policies were viewed as a temporary fix. The hope was that policy settings soon would return to pre-crisis norms, but with one shock following another, the exit strategy keeps being deferred. This raises perhaps the most troublesome concern of all. With the post-crisis world getting hit by one shock after another, and with central banks having no latitude to cut interest rates, it is not hard to envision a scenario of open-ended monetary expansion that ends in tears. The dreaded inflationary endgame suddenly looms as a very real possibility." Stephen Roach continues, "None of this detracts from the resilience factor. Yes, Japan will rebuild. But just as the post-Kobe rebuilding, that was 1995, did little to end the first half of Japan's lost decades, a similar outcome can be expected this time. The upside of rebuilding is only a temporary palliative for an impaired economy. The Japanese economy has in fact been on the leading edge of many of the more serious problems that have afflicted the global economy in recent years. From asset bubbles and a dysfunctional financial system to currency suppression and monetary policy blunders, Japan has been in many respects the laboratory of our future. Unfortunately, the world has failed to learn the lessons of Japan and now risk missing another important clue. The significance of the earthquake and tsunami of 2011 is not the relatively low magnitude of Japan's direct impact on the global, on the broader global economy. The more meaningful message is how these shocks box the rest of us into an even tighter corner." That was economist Stephen Roach. The Dow Jones this week rose 3% to close at 12,220. We're essentially back to the levels before Libya blew up and oil was $85. Today it's 105. The S&P 500 rose 2.7% and NASDAQ climbed 3.4%. That's all for this week. Again, go to stocksnews.com, click on Week in Review. Have a good one, and I'll talk to you next Saturday.